So we are continuing our lesson through Romans, and we have been looking at the same section that we're going to read, verses 9 through 21. This is our third week looking at this section, and I do expect to be here for a few more weeks. And the title of this is Unfeigned Love, Part 3. So starting in Romans 12, verse 9, it reads, "Let love be without dissimulation, abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality, bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not, rejoice with them that do rejoice and weep with them that weep, be of the same mind one toward another, mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." Pastor, will you pray for our Sunday school lesson this morning? So again, I know I've said this in the preface, but we're saying it again, is continuing our look at Romans 12, and 12 marks a significant change where we are taking the knowledge that we have been exposed to in the first 11 verses and really turning it into instruction for how we should behave, what our pattern or behavior should be. And this is an important thing because that means that our behavior is not acceptable, that the knowledge is given for a purpose, that there is a transition that needs to occur in each one of us that is a pattern behavior that has to change, and not just a pattern behavior. So as we look over it, we come to the understanding, and we have been taught many times here, but for those who may be listening afterwards, I think with a brief cover, and it's not going to be in depth of, by any stretch, is we can have all the actions we want, but unless those actions come from a place of truth, they are false. We've all dealt with the salesman friend that is a wonderful friend while you're in their presence, and you're pretty sure they forget who you are the minute they turn around. There is no lasting friendship to it. You're there because whatever sale I can make. And the reason I bring up salesmen is because Christians can often have that connotation of, can be compared to being salesmen. Don't we have that mentality? If I can just get a hold of them, if I could just sell them the truth? I mean, after all, we're told to buy the truth and sell it not, right? And I think, unfortunately, that is an improper philosophy that we take on. We don't need to sell him. We just need to tell who he is. It is not our job to upsell Christianity. It is not our job to upsell Christ. It is to declare it and let him have his work. Because people know when you're trying to sell versus just stating something. I will share this just because it works, and this is, I'm just going to share it, so take it for what it's worth. Keegan rides a scooter around the neighborhood. It's one of the things he does for, that's his way of, I'm annoyed, I need to go out. So he takes his scooter, and he's gone for about 15 minutes, typically. He comes back, we see him fly down the driveway, he runs up the stairs. Dad, the Jehovah's Witnesses are coming, And it's like Paul Revere on a scooter, and I'm like, Keegan, it's okay. They're going to knock on the door. It's fine. I'll handle it. He's like, Dad. I'm like, Keegan, it's okay. It's fine. And we laugh, and I use that because is that not a salesman approach? I'm not saying if you're told to go knock on doors, you don't go knock on doors. But if we treat him as sales, we've missed it. Instead, if we live the way we should with true love, love unfeigned, if we demonstrate his worth in our lives, that declares who he is, and that will have a work of changing someone's life. One of my favorite questions, if a salesman is trying to sell me something, I ask if they use it. Well, no, you see, that's all I need to know. If you're trying to sell me a Ford and you're driving a Chevy, just tell me where you bought your Chevy. I'll go talk to that sales guy because they probably did a better job, didn't they? Our life and the way we present ourselves in verse 1 is that living sacrifice. That demonstrates to others what our true values are. And the imagery that pops into my head, right or wrong, NASCAR. NASCAR isn't just a plain car with a number, is it? Every single car has a sponsorship writing on it. And there's often a joke that I wish they would do the same thing with our congresspeople, if they could wear the patches of who bought them. And I'm not going to go any further than that because that's not my place. But when you see a NASCAR, there's hundreds of sponsors all over it. You see who they're demonstrating. If they stop and win, it's okay. If you hold the bottle of Gatorade, make sure you spin it so everyone can see you and you get that mandatory sip that they can see that I'm sponsored by Powerade. And if they don't like it, it's a plastic bottle that looks like it, that probably has water, because water is a good thing. Sponsorship, that's what they're trying to sell. Oh, look, this is how I'm living. And I'm not saying we have to go out and buy the shirts that say Jesus is the only one, and I'm not against that, but that doesn't demonstrate his value in our life. It's when we truly live and demonstrate through our interaction with others that we prove what his value is. When we start taking on his fruit, his love. And that doesn't happen if it's only our actions, if it's only our goals. But it has to be our change in motives, our change in our heart. And so we have heard it here, and this is where the blurb is going to be. Our motives is what drives us, and that determines what our goals are going to be, and that determines what our actions are going to be, and it's going to determine what the fruit's going to be. And we looked at this a little bit more in depth when we looked at the olive tree. But we can't change our motives, we can't change our directives, we can't change our drives. We can fool ourselves and think we change our fruit. We think we can change our actions, we think we can change our goals, but each one of these is love faked. Until the motive is just because I'm starting to take on the mind of Christ, which is the second verse that we looked at, is be renewed, to be transformed. Start coming in line with his thinking. And our motives will not change until we see the world as he sees them. And real briefly, we looked at the church being the body of Christ and need to have the same mindset. And also, this love is demonstrated through our service. Whether it's ministry, whether it's teaching, giving, ruling, showing mercy, all of these specific actions that are outlined has to be done in accordance to what he has revealed to be appropriate for the body. This past week, Sydney was asking me about preaching. And I said, well, there's a lot of noise, but is there a lot of content? Oh, sure. If I start jumping right now, one, Jenny's going to have a nurse panic attack and wondering what's going on, and talk to Sherry and make sure nothing is happening here. But you're all going to be like, what is going on? What's happening? It's immediately going to draw your attention. And if I start doing that Southern gospel pull in and start doing this, we're start getting excited, aren't we? If I start raising my voice and I start talking fast and I get enthusiastic, people start drawing in. But did anything I say mean anything just now? No, it's just words, it's just motions, it's just riling up. And so just like love, when I was talking about preaching to my daughter, I go, absolutely, we should be excited about who God is and what he is doing. And that's fine to have that passion, but if it doesn't come back to the Lord Jesus Christ is God, it is hot air. Unless it draws us to a deeper revelation with him, or it draws us toward him, or it says, how do I get myself in line with him? It is hot air. Unless it draws me closer to him, unless it makes me cleave to him more, then it's hot air. I know we've been, it was like, wow, it was a great service. What'd he talk about? It was a great service. I really enjoyed it. I'm not saying, can you remember the title? I don't know the title. I have to look back on my stuff to make sure I'm not using the same title four or five times. And if I am, tough. I'm sorry, you're getting someone with short-term memory. But unless it contains him, it's hot air. Unless our actions contain him, it's hot air. The other danger to it is we can start often having that fire, that fervency of spirit. But sometimes we get bogged down by the work. You know what happens then, right? The focus is not on him. The focus is on the work that's being done. I'm guilty of this, so this is me speaking from experience. I'm not calling on any of you. If you happen to join me in this, sorry, this is what I have. What happens when you start losing focus of who you're doing it for, you start looking at what you're doing. You start looking at what you're doing, you start getting burnt out. You start getting burnt out, you start resenting it. Am I the only one when there's a call for extra service, my immediate mindset is, I got to go back there again this week? I'm guilty of it. Because I'm so busy thinking about the items that I have to do at church that I've lost sight of who. And I know I'm not alone there. Because I look across other faces that we feel like we are working so hard to reach Enfield. And how about you, but I feel like I'm running on one of those endless treadmills like they have for dogs where you put your leash on. You're like, get on it and run as fast as you can. And what if I accomplished nothing? But he got his exercise out. You burnt out that fervency. You burnt out that looking to him. You feel run down. Now your love starts lacking and you're just going through the motions again because you lost your love. You lost your fervency. You lost looking toward him. And when that happens, the body breaks down. You know, going outside when you're cold doesn't make you get sick. What makes you get sick is when your body is worn down and you go out into the cold and it causes your immune system to drop. It's not that the cold's waiting out there. It's that if your immune system isn't kept up, if your body is not operating properly, it's going to get sick. And it's going to need to heal because it needs rest. But how often do we put ourselves in the same situation? We think it's the current circumstances that are making us sick, but it's not. It's because the day-to-day has slipped. We no longer look to him first thing in the morning. Instead, we say, what list of things do I have to get done before I can go to bed again? Because I am just absolutely exhausted. If I can just get through everything, maybe I can get to bed by 10. If I can get up by 6, then I can get 8 hours, which is what the doctor recommended. We're not going to worry about the fact that it's a 3-to-1 ratio. If you lost sleep, they say it takes 3 extra hours to catch up on an hour of sleep. And when you run yourself out, 8 hours might take care of today, but that's not worried about the 3,000-hour log that you've burnt yourself out for. And yet we refuse to enter into his rest, and his rest is his spirit within us. We refuse to enter into that rest. And I look at my own life and realize the absurdity of that. That he dwelleth in me, but I refuse to enter into his kingdom. That I'm so busy sitting on my throne dictating what has to be done in his kingdom that I've taken him off of it. That I've taken off the wise king that tells me when I should rest and when I should recover and that I should look to him. And instead, we burn ourselves out to the point that who cares? Not even drudgery anymore. The problem is after it becomes a job, you dislike it, detest it, don't want nothing to do with it because now it's an obligation. If our Christianity has become an obligation, we have lost it. If it comes just I have to do this every day, we've missed it. And I understand that the only true good motive for serving him is because he is God, period. Not because what he provides for me. But if we get to the point that I am just doing it because I'm obligated to do it, then we've missed his goodness. We have taken him out of proper place in our life because we aren't called to be slaves. We are called to be adopted sons. And don't take him off the throne. He's still God. But if we lost that personal relationship, he is out of place in our lives. And if he is out of place in our lives, it doesn't matter the actions that we do. They're false. How can I tell someone he loves them if I've gotten myself into a mindset that doesn't believe it for me? I've been there. We've all been there. We don't want to discuss it because that means we're failures. Christianity's got the same thing where there's things we don't want to discuss because God forbid we let him have his way with those things. God forbid that we actually have failures that we need him to address in our lives. Well, it's not that. We're letting parts of ourselves be like Adam and hide from him instead of going to him and saying, Lord, something is wrong. I don't feel it. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to address it, but I know you can. Fix what is broken, because I don't even know what's broken. It's just not working in here. And it says the Holy Ghost uttereth on our behalf. We went over that previously in Romans, because if we are looking to him, that our spirit knows what is wrong. He knows what we need if we would only go to him. But we become so embarrassed for our separation from him, or so naive to think that he doesn't see it, that he doesn't know us. And these things cause us to have love faked, to go through the motions. And I want to say that's not because we've lost sincerity. It is possible to be 100% sincere in our own minds and still be angry and disgruntled. Because that's what comes after disgruntled, is angry. Because if I can't fix it, then obviously I'm not the problem. And if I can get angry at God and be justified in it, after anger, I don't need him. Why do I want to serve with somebody who makes me angry all the time? Because we've lost sight of who he is. And it's tough to carry out that entwining with him when we want to put stuff wedged in between. Because the next verse after love unfeigned is entwine yourself with that which is good. Get away from that which is evil. You know, the entwine shouldn't break apart. But you know, even the best wood glue will not stop rotting wood. Rotting wood will fall off. Even though it would have life from it, it can still fall off if we allow the rot to get in there. And that's why we are told to not be slothful in business. We are told to be fervent in spirit serving the Lord. Because we don't always feel fervent. And I feel that it's worth clarifying now, I am not condemning when we don't feel it. We will all get to a place where we don't feel it. That is part of our normal emotions. That's part of our normal wake up, is when the emotions come in, we just don't feel it. And that would be great if love was a feel it. Love is an act of the will. There is no condemnation for how you feel about it. But understand, regardless of how you feel about it, get a hold of him. Because when you don't feel it, he hasn't changed. When you're worn out, he hasn't changed. When you no longer have that love and you no longer have that, you go to him. If we don't go to him, that's when we have the problem. But if we go to him, he is sure and he will renew us. His love is never ending. His love doesn't fail. He is unchanging, but we change. But we have to be fervent in spirit. Even if we don't feel it, we still have to give him priority in our lives. And I can say that because when I look through the Bible, all the demonstration that I have of mankind is mankind who didn't feel it. Did Jonah feel it when he went the complete opposite direction? Looking through Romans, we can say, did Abraham really feel that when he decided to do his own thing and have Ishmael? But it says Abraham obeyed God. There's means there's hope for me even when I don't feel it. There's hope for me when I feel burnt out. There's hope for me if I don't have his love. The fact that he says, to be fervent means that it is possible. I don't know about you, but that gives me hope. But that also means that it's not me, that I need him to be fervent in spirit, because I didn't have his spirit until I saw him and I submitted to him and he became active in my life. And it's only by that that I can be fervent in spirit, is if I stoke the flames. And again, this isn't condemnation to anybody, but if you feel a burning right now, that's because it's still smoldering. You want that flame that burn, he's the one. And we can go through each one of these ones that we talked about. And if we have lost track of him, we won't feel it. I don't know about you, but when I'm at my end, I'm not rejoicing in hope. I'm not rejoicing in hope. I'm like, yeah, God's got it under control, and one day I'll die. I'm not saying, please, everybody's listening, pay attention. I'm not saying I want to end it. That's not what I'm saying. Do not call the help hotline. I'm not looking to end it. What I'm saying is, at least someday I'll die, because there's no relief. When I look forward, it's, hey, I have to do another 30, 50, 60 years before I can retire. And with today's economic, you know, if I die at work, maybe Sherry will get a bonus. But it's good, because at least one day I'll die. What does that speak about our hope? Are we truly rejoicing in hope if that is our mindset? I'll just make it through another day until there's not another day I have to make it through. If that is our mindset, we've missed it. But isn't that patience and tribulation? I could be tongue-in-cheek, right? I mean, that's how I'm going to read it, because that's how I feel. But Lord, I am being patient in tribulation. I'm patient and then I'll die. I see a lot of smirks because I know you've been there. We've all been there. But if we are not truly awaiting him, we've missed it. Patience in tribulation isn't just sit there and get beaten, but it's to see things from his mindset, to understand that he has all things under control. Not, I guess I'll be God's whipping boy another day. If that's the mindset, that might be why there's tribulation. To get you out of the mindset that you need to be a whipping boy. I can say that. And here's my assurity of it. If he wanted us to be whipping boys, we already have enough problems. He did not have to reveal himself. He'd be perfectly justified in beating all of us relentlessly forever for our fallen condition. He would not have come and revealed himself if we were meant to be beaten for the sake of being beaten. But when we have this mindset taken off of him, that's what we think about tribulation and trials. Oh, don't get me wrong, I know we can reap what we sow and there will be returns for our behaviors, but if we think God puts us in that position just to do that, you're out of your mind. Because he is merciful. Those situations of being patient is to come to an understanding of what we need to change in our lives, so that the beatings can discontinue. What parent wants to keep punishing their child when they're doing the right thing? If that's the parent, that's not a good parent. A good parent only uses it to get away from behaviors that are going to cause pain. The worst part is when we get to that place, we justify abusing the members of his body. I don't have to give any examples. We know. Well, I'm just aggravated, so you get what you deserve. You shouldn't have come up to me like that. Well, that's completely opposite of everything that we've read through here about love being unfeigned, about giving preference to the brother, about the giving the necessity for what the other brother needs, for the edifying of the body, for the perfecting of the saints. And verse 14 is impossible with this mindset. And I know it's taken a while to get here, but this was the main verse that I wanted to get to this week. Was bless them which persecute you. Bless and curse not. It is impossible to bless if he is not in us. It says, out of our mouth our treasures come out. What we put in, what we bury in here is what comes out of our mouth. And if you look at the second half of the verse, there's two real options to those who persecute you. There's blessing and cursing. I wish there was a third option where I can remain Switzerland. It doesn't say that. It says, bless and curse not. There's your opposites. What is in you determines, are you blessing or are you cursing? It is impossible to bless unless he is here. Unless you have buried him and his principles in your heart. Unless you see things from his point of view, it is impossible to bless people. Oh, you can pretend. Someone sneezes, God bless you. Do you really mean that? No. It's a habit we take, and because, A, you didn't die. We thought your heart was going to stop, and it kept beating, so God bless you. Am I really worried about their life? No. I'm worried that if I didn't say it, people are going to think I'm rude. And my brain takes about 10 seconds to go, someone sneezed. That was rude of them. Wait a minute. I didn't say God bless you. I'm being the rude one. God bless you. My immediate reaction is, keep it down. I'm trying to work here. Seriously? How dare you interrupt my day with an involuntary reaction? But the truth is, we can't bless people if we don't have him in us. We can give the platitudes, we can give the actions, we can pretend, but it is all fake. And looking at that word bless is actually a combination of two Greek words. And I'm not going to go into the Greek. One, because I don't want to speak Greek today. But two, this gives you an opportunity to open up the word and study to verify what I'm saying is true. But it has two parts to it. One, to be well, to be prosperous. And two, speech, the declaration of. And that reason that that's important is you can only speak what you know. And prosperity to be well, I'm going to put it in my own speech. To bless means to speak life. And you're not going to be able to speak life unless life is in you. How can you speak about that which is good if you don't demonstrate it and don't have it? Well, you don't understand those who can't teach. So I'm just using it as a teaching opportunity. That has never been meant as a compliment. That is an insult. Speak those things which give life. You can't do that if you have fake Christianity. And what I find interesting is that word persecute doesn't mean someone who just happens to offend you, someone who does you wrong. But to persecute is to actively chase and pursue someone. It was used in Acts 8:1, and I'm pretty sure Paul knew exactly what he was talking about when he used the word persecute. Because when Saul was consenting unto his death, and he's talking about the death of Stephen, and at that time there was great persecution against the church, which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Paul actively pursued. So this isn't talking about someone who, walking down the hallway, happens to bump against your arm and, you know, you taken aback, and how dare they? An accidental. This is someone who is actively pursuing you all the time. That is actively looking for a reason to give you offense. That is actively looking to make your life miserable. Well, if there's someone who's chasing me all the time, it is well within my right to absolutely crush and destroy them so they no longer pursue me. Right? If I break both their kneecaps, the worst they can do is crawl after me. And it's probably not going to be very fast, and that's going to give me enjoyment. So they're no longer persecuting me. Instead, they're amusing me. Plus, I feel better about taking care of business, don't I? And I've looked, and there's no justification for that. There's no permission to do that. For those who are actively engaged in making your life miserable, the response is to speak life to them. That is not my reaction at all. I no way, shape, or form want to speak life to them. And just in case we missed it, the follow-up by Paul is, bless and curse not. Well, you got me there, Paul. I was going to say is, after this beating, God can give you life. If he raised Lazarus, he'll raise you when I'm done. But there's no leeway given for us to curse them. It says, curse not. And that's not talking physical. That's just using our mouth. One, it shouldn't be in our hearts. But two, that shouldn't come out of our hearts or come out of our mouths. If he is truly God in our life and we are demonstrating his love, then we should see them as he sees them. Did he say, I'm going to die on the cross for this select few? But you pursued me, you know, you hypocrites and Pharisees, and you're out. My life is only given for this select group of people. I think there are quite a few people who actively pursued him are the same ones who put him on the cross. And if you think I'm accusing anybody, the people who he went on the cross for is wearing your nose. But did he fight back on them? We can use his example of what did he do? He spoke truth to those that persecuted him. He spoke life and not cursing. To be able to speak life, you have to have the two requirements. First, you have to know the truth. It has to be buried away to speak about it. You have to know it. And second, you have to bring in what you have to bring out what you put in. And the problem with the mindset that we talked about earlier is it no longer comes out because we've drained our battery to the point where we're not charging. I have three batteries that I use for, I know the word, it's just stuck somewhere. Vroom, 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 the lines spin, it kills the weeds. Weed whacker, thank you. It was there, the image was there, but I have three batteries I use for the weed whacker. And you know, you're supposed to use it until it slows down, and once it slows down, the responsible person will then take the battery and put it inside and let it cool down for a bit and then grab a fresh battery, plug it in, and go about their day. The irresponsible, hi, this is me, I keep using it until every time I click it, it does nothing. And then I make sure I try and charge it. And then I wonder why when I plug it in, it flashes red because it's too drained to charge. Wow, I killed the battery. Shouldn't be shocking. Unrelated, it had to be on that charger for about a week, trickling in, and I take it off and let it cool down for a day, and then I can put it back on and it will charge. Do you know what happens? It gets so depleted, it is unable to accept the charge that's going into it. It becomes so exhausted from the work it's performed, it no longer will accept any charge. It's not until it can no longer do work for a period of time that it can then take a charge. How do we treat our life so differently? We run ourselves down to the point that we say we need to stop. And I'm not just saying stop working, but sometimes that stop is sometimes I just need to go sit somewhere because I feel like I'm drying out. And not just because I can't sleep at night and I know if I start reading Deuteronomy that I'll be out two chapters in. That's not really getting it in us, is it? It's just I know that if I trick my body into think I'm doing something spiritual, my body's going to say, okay, nap time. But do we ever get to the place where we recognize, Lord, what is happening right now in my spirit is inappropriate. I don't know what it is. And then do we go about our business? We keep pulling that trigger. I know there's something wrong, Lord, and I should run to you, but as soon as I'm done, and then we get to the point that no matter how hard we squeeze the trigger, it won't work because the battery is completely dead. Because the warning signs were there where we're running out is it wasn't just, Lord, you know something's wrong, can you fix it? Instead of taking the time to actively pursue him and recharge, instead we think a quick prayer of, Lord, you know, is adequate. He knows. That's not wrong. That's not false. That's truth. He knows. A little bit of a misapplication on our part, isn't it? I love it. Truthfully. We love the gray area because we feel like we're justified in doing the things that we shouldn't be doing as long as there's just enough coverage to be like, Lord, I didn't know. I did what you said. As a parent, when your kids say that, you're like, you know exactly what I meant when I said, you know, I can't open the door to your room. This needs to be taken care of. What they do, they took everything from behind the door and put it in the middle of the room. Now I can't get into the room, but the door opens freely. But Dad, I obeyed the letter of the law. Aren't you proud of me? And it's the feeling I get that I can't help but want to portray God looking at my life. Of just, I just sent a messenger last week about this problem. They didn't listen. I know that's my personal thing, but I can't help but feel that way, that sometimes he just goes, like, he knows, so he's not surprised. But in my head, I just can't help but feel he's like, what do I got to do to this guy? He's not getting it. He's not paying attention. I've been throwing every trial and tribulation at his life, and he just won't get it. I've smacked him upside the head a couple of times. He just doesn't get it. And I hope you appreciate my humor that I'm not putting at God being frustrated that he is out of options, but putting in our own head, in my own thinking, I can't help but just God wanting to just walk up behind me, lick his hand, and just smack me right in the back of the head. Pay attention. Like, I don't know how I can make it any clearer to you. But it's okay, because I said, Lord, you know, and I was very sincere before I drained myself, before I took myself off his path, before I was so exhausted that I stopped walking. And then I sat down because I was tired of standing. And then I took a nap where I was sitting, off the path, but I needed the rest. And I wake up so unrefreshed because I didn't take the rest that he gave me. And then I continue doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results, which I think some people have determined to be the definition of insanity. But when those time comes, do we really, and this is the question for us today, is when those times come where we say, God, you know, oh, he knows. Just like when he asks us a question, we should know. When we say, Lord, you know, do we stop and consider we don't? If he asks a question, we need to know the answer. But the times of our lives, when we so, for frustration, some things aren't for us to know, but when we get to the place and say, Lord, you know, have you stopped to consider maybe it's your time to sit down and ask him about it? To truly give time to listen to what he says and not just make a grumbling pass? Do we really separate ourselves enough to get recharged? Lord, you know. In other words, I'm making this your problem instead of mine. I want divine intervention instead of me having to do anything on my path to make sure our relationship is appropriate. Lord, you take care of it. I'm going to do what needs to be done. I think all too often in our lives, we make this relationship one-sided, knowing full well it's him, but he wants to have communication with us. That there should be back and forth where we spend time in his presence getting to know him versus saying, well, Lord, you know, you're so big, I could never understand you, and I know you revealed yourself, so I'm not even going to bother with the effort. Just feed me. Have we stopped to make sure that our relationship is sure? Have we stopped in a times of difficulty and just said, Lord, I am overwhelmed? So I'm just going to sit at your feet. I don't want to just be the servant going about everything, but I want to make sure that I'm doing what you want me to do, how you want me to do. Do we take the time in our lives to sit down and see what He truly wants for us? Or are we so busy going about what we think He wants us to do? Have you recharged lately? We've got one verse in chapter 12 covered, so we will be continuing multiple parts of unfeigned love still. But seriously, this week, when we have those moments when we are overwhelmed, don't just stop and throw out a one-liner and go about our day, but let's actually start taking time out to demonstrate the priority of His relationship with us. When we get overwhelmed, do we truly run to the rock? Do we truly run to His stronghold? Do we truly get a hold of Him? Or do we just have a passerby relationship of, Lord, You're doing Your work, I'm doing Your work. Catch you on the rebound. See you on Sunday, Lord. I'll be there, I'll worship You then. Do we take time out to make sure that we truly have that personal relationship dwelling so that our life can demonstrate Him? Brother Don Cash, will you pray a closing for our Sunday school today?